I think Trump announced the withdrawal from Afghanistan simply because he was fed up with staying there.
The political scenario in South Asia could have changed drastically over the past week. This is Thursday, December 27th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Join us on VOA Asia Facebook right now. Also ahead, fearing another calamity, officials are trying to keep people away from beaches in Indonesia. We look back on the plight of the Rohingya, and you'll hear about a new vision of an amusement park. All on today's VOA Asia. Pakistan this week held a fresh round of discussions with their staunch ally China on what they call the evolving political dynamics in Afghanistan. Amid reports, the United States plans to reduce its military presence in the war-ravaged country. Officials said Pakistani Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi traveled to Beijing Tuesday for day-long discussions with Chinese counterpart Wang Yi. Both sides underscored support for an Afghan-led and Afghan-owned peace process. Last week, Pakistan organized what officials said were substantial talks between U.S. and Afghan Taliban representatives in the United Arab Emirates. Now, Pakistan media reports the talks were arranged after the U.S. President Donald Trump wrote a letter to Prime Minister Imran Khan seeking Pakistan's help in mending Afghan peace process. The overture came after a patch of tense ties between the U.S. and Pakistan since President Trump last year announced his Afghanistan and South Asia strategy, in which Islamabad was accused of not acting against terrorist safe havens. Joining us on VOA Asia is Michael Kugelman, the Deputy Director of the Asia Program and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center. Michael, how do you decipher what's going on here?
Well, there's a lot to unpack for sure. I think that the President Trump's decision to withdraw half of the U.S. troop presence in Afghanistan has set in motion a lot of diplomacy. And I think that Pakistan now sees that it can play an even bigger role than it had originally thought it could play in a potential peace process with Afghanistan. I mean, I think that the fact that President Trump has now declared a partial withdrawal from the country, I think will really cause the U.S. to lose a lot of leverage at the negotiating table, simply because it's basically given the Taliban what it's always wanted, and the Taliban hasn't had to give up anything in return. So on the assumption that the U.S. role and presence in Afghanistan will be receding quite soon, I think that allows Pakistan an opportunity to step up to the plate and use its influence to work with the Taliban to try to bring it to the peace table. And I think that it would look to certain partner countries. And in this case, essentially all of the countries that Foreign Minister Qureshi has traveled to or is planning to travel to, China, Russia, and Iran. And, you know, the ironic thing, as you know, is these are countries that don't get along with the U.S., but they're countries that do get along with Pakistan, and which Pakistan feels can help Islamabad try to bring the Taliban to the table and try to start talking.
Is this what you think President Trump meant to do?
No, not at all. I mean, I think that the optimistic view is you could say, okay, Trump decided to announce this withdrawal of 7,000 troops as an olive branch. It was meant to extend an olive branch to the Taliban. It was meant to be a concession to say, well, look, we know that you've always have wanted us to indicate that we're ready to withdraw our forces. And then, you know, we've done that. And now, you know, we'd like you to step up to the plate, and we'd like you to start talking and negotiating an end to the war, preferably with the Afghan government. But I don't think that's what's happened. I don't think that Trump announced this withdrawal of U.S. troops because of anything connected to the fledgling peace process with the Taliban. I think Trump announced this withdrawal from Afghanistan simply because he was fed up with staying there. He had never been comfortable in Afghanistan. You know, he almost, according to his own claims, he almost decided to pull out last year instead of agreeing to stay and add a few thousand more troops. So I think that he felt that now was the time. He, of course, had also announced a withdrawal of U.S. troops from Syria, and he thinks he's looking at the domestic political situation in the U.S. He knows that he's increasingly vulnerable. He knows that presidential election is not that far away. The U.S. presidential election is not far away, and he knows that his core base in the U.S. does not support extended military U.S. military presences abroad. So I think that he was basically just making a unilateral declaration of the withdrawal because he just was had concluded that he does not want to be in Afghanistan anymore.
Michael Kugelman, Deputy Director of the Asia Program and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Washington-based Wilson Center. Michael, let me ask you to hold on through our break here. I want to ask you where this goes from here. These are among the top Asia stories you'll find right now on VOAnews.com. President Donald Trump makes an unannounced visit to Iraq to visit U.S. troops stationed there. One of the alleged masterminds of an attack by a Pakistani separatist group on the Chinese consulate in Karachi last month has been killed along with five associates, that according to the insurgent group itself. A search is underway for 152 Vietnamese who arrived in Taiwan on tourist visas and then vanished. Local media report they may have come to the island to work illegally. And South Korean investigators raided the presidential compound Wednesday to probe allegations that President Moon Jae-in's administration abused its powers to conduct surveillance on private citizens. Expanded coverage of these and other stories on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA Asia. We've been talking with South Asia expert Michael Kugelman about the new political map that's being drawn after reports of the United States will pull out half of its troops out of Afghanistan. Michael remains with us now. Michael, where do you see the scenario going?
Well, I mean, it's complicated. There are a lot. I mean, I think the most immediate concern is that if this decision to withdraw 7,000 troops is implemented, it could plunge Afghanistan into even more instability than it's already in now. I think that if you withdraw 7,000 U.S. troops, that's going to make the job of the Afghan security forces, who are already beleaguered, even more difficult. You're going to have a huge battlefield advantage for the Taliban. And I think that with so many foreign troops pulling out, the Taliban will not be more compelled to negotiate an end to the war. It'll be more compelled to take up arms again and pick up the fight and try to overthrow the Afghan government. So I think that's the thing to the most immediate concern. Just recently, the Afghan government announced that it would be postponing its presidential election. It was originally scheduled for April of next year for an indefinite period. I think that if we look at these two factors, the U.S. with partial withdrawal from Afghanistan coupled with the postponement of the Afghan election, I think this spells a lot of uncertainty, a lot of instability. And given the, the uncertainties as to when the election will actually happen, that could lead some type of, some opponents of the Afghan government or others that are just uneasy to take to the streets to try to exploit the uncertainty and the instability, and it could plunge Afghanistan into an even greater crisis than it's in right now. So unfortunately, not many optimistic scenarios to put out there at this point.
What about Russia? What about China? What about Iran as far as where they are placed in this game of chess now?
Yeah, well, all of these countries are, are at a net advantage with the U.S. planning to essentially have its role recede in Afghanistan. These are countries, Russia, Iran, and China, that have already been trying to deepen their footprint in the country. They've already been trying to be involved in efforts to bring the Taliban to the peace table. And certainly that will continue. I think they're just going to get more involved in efforts to bring the insurgents to the table. And I think that, that to me suggests a bit of a strategic defeat for the United States in that, the United States is going to see, as the United States starts to move away from Afghanistan, it's going to see some of its top strategic rivals in the world. And I'm talking about Russia, I'm talking about China, I'm talking about Iran. They will all benefit. They will all get to be in a better position to make an imprint on Afghanistan and try to pursue their own interests, which on some levels are similar to the U.S. They all want to see stability. They all want to see an end to the war. But at the same time, to be sure, they are certainly at odds with the United States on some levels as well, just because of their overall policy. policies that are at odds with the U.S. So, you know, you could be an optimist and think, okay, you're going to have three significant countries trying to throw their hats in the ring and try to convince the Taliban to get to the peace table. But at the same time, these are countries that do not get along with the U.S., that do have a tendency to play nefarious roles in other countries, and I think that should be cause for concern.
Michael Kugelman, Deputy Director of the Asia Program and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center. Happening now in Asia, Pakistani journalists say they now face a form of censorship spearheaded by the security services there. Journalists and press freedom advocates say the military and the powerful Inter-Services Intelligence Agency are pressuring media outlets to quash critical coverage. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us. Indonesian authorities are urging people to avoid the coast in areas where a tsunami killed at least 430 people over the weekend, and a fresh warning issued on the anniversary of the catastrophic 2004 Asian earthquake and tsunami. The big waves that followed an eruption on a volcanic island hit communities along the Sunda Strait on Saturday night. The eruption of Anak Krakatau, or Child of Krakatoa, is believed to have set off a large landslide on the volcano, apparently on its slope and underwater, displacing water that slammed into Java and Sumatra Islands. AP correspondent Margie Wilson on the scene. Meet that Margie Mason. She says Indonesian authorities are asking people to avoid the coast in areas where the tsunami struck.
They're not able to tell exactly what's going on with the volcano and predict what it's going to do next. So they are just warning people just to be safe, to stay back at least 500 meters and up to a kilometer away from the coast.
Indonesia's Meteorology, Geophysics, and Climatology Agency was monitoring Anak Krakatau's eruptions as stormy weather and high surf continued to plague the area. The tsunami struck without warning, taking people by surprise, even in a country familiar with seismic disasters. No big earthquake shook the ground beforehand, and it hit at night on a holiday weekend while people were enjoying concerts and other beach and resort activities. Here's correspondent Mason.
People described rolling in the water and being thrown into coconut trees or being thrown into concrete buildings. They also described this immense force as the waves started to suck back to the sea and having to use almost all of the strength that they had to hold on to fences or trees or cables or anything they could get their hands on.
The devastation was vast, and the disaster was among the worst in recent history. Saturday's event, coupled with an earthquake and tsunami in September on Indonesia's Sulawesi Island, killed at least 2,100 people. Correspondent Mason says aid is arriving in the country, but not all of it arriving where it's needed.
Aid has been getting through to a lot of the areas, but some people still have yet to get aid, or there may be some people who are still injured and haven't been able to get medical assistance. So they have called for heavy machinery to be brought into some of these areas that are more remote.
The country's system of tsunami detection buoys deployed after the 2004 disaster has not worked since 2012, with some units being stolen or vandalized. Anak Krakatau, formed in the early 20th century near the site of the cataclysmic 1883 eruption of Krakatoa, one that killed more than 30,000 people. It's been erupting since June, did so again 24 minutes before the tsunami, according to the Geophysics Agency. This is VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
This news alert from VOA Asia. North and South Korea held a groundbreaking ceremony Wednesday to mark the start of a joint project to connect railways throughout the divided peninsula. The event was held after both Koreas inspected railways along the peninsula's east coast. A special train carried 100 South Korean officials and 100 North Korean people to the ceremony at Panmun Station in the border city of Kaesong. This is VOA Asia. We continue now. More than 750,000 Rohingya Muslim refugees who fled military attacks in Myanmar remain in Bangladesh camps as future repatriation and resettlement plans remain unclear. Steve Sanford reports on the challenges that lie ahead for the Rohingya in the coming year.
Across the sprawling camps in Cox's Bazar, close to a million Rohingya Muslim refugees remain in limbo, without a clear future. Voluntary repatriation plans last month were postponed amid security concerns about ongoing abuses and a lack of international monitoring. Published footage of a resettlement compound being built on the remote Basanchar Island is another cause for concern, says a rights activist.
UNHCR has not been let on to the island right now to be able to do a risk assessment of the flood conditions. But many say that the island is prone to flooding and very dangerous. That means that hundreds of thousands of Rohingya refugees could potentially be on a flood-prone island.
While the long-term impact on the Rohingya population has yet to be felt, the prolonged refusal of education will be damaging, says John Quinley.
There is no formalized access to education in the camps right now. Rohingya that Fortify Rights has spoken with believe that this is a major issue for future generations of Rohingya children and youth.
Yet it is unclear if the Rohingya will have anywhere to go back to in Myanmar someday. Myanmar authorities say land that has been burned becomes government-managed property, casting into doubt the ownership of more than 200 Rohingya villages that were burned to the ground in the past year and a half. Rohingya lawyer Jala Ong, a humanitarian award recipient, says official records can prove rightful ownership, provided they are requested.
They have all the documents, all the records in land record office and in home minister. International community should ask the government to show this record.
Analysts see Myanmar's position as a deliberate attempt to eliminate the ethnic group, a charge consistently denied by officials in Myanmar.
The government making us to be illiterate so that they can allege these people, they are illegal immigrants from Bangladesh. They have no knowledge of the country, no knowledge of the world.
As the new year approaches, many in the camps wish for a peaceful future. Steve Sanford for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Japan will resume hunting whales for commercial purposes next year, ending decades-long fight with anti-whaling nations and environmentalists. The Chief Cabinet Secretary, Yoshihide Suga, announced Wednesday that Japan will withdraw from the International Whaling Commission effective June 30th and resume commercial whaling. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. In Russia, there is a temple where people can explore more than one religion, a lot more than one. VOA's Deborah Block has the story.
It is called appropriately the Temple of All Religions, a mosque, an Orthodox church, a synagogue, and more, all combined under one roof. The temple, which aims to promote interreligious understanding, is located in the city of Kazan, 800 kilometers southwest of Moscow. Work on the temple began in 1992 after local architect, philanthropist, and healer Ildar Konev said he was visited by Jesus Christ. Konev died in 2013, and his brother has taken over the task of completing the building.
Jesus Christ showed himself to my brother and told him to start digging the foundation of the temple. My brother said, "I don't have money to do this." But Christ told him, "You just start and then see what happens." And the result is this temple.
The structure reflects the architectural styles of different religions and includes faiths that are no longer practiced, such as ancient Egyptian beliefs. There is an Egypt Hall, Jesus Christ Hall, Catholic Hall, and Buddhist Room, says the temple manager.
People come here because the place is unusual. There is no other temple like it in the world.
The project is helped financially by donations from visitors. This visitor is from Indonesia, home to the world's largest Muslim population.
We don't have to be feel different each other. Even we are different, we have different religion, and in this place show me that we have to tolerate each other.
Another visitor is spinning around in the Buddhist room.
Here, there is calm energy and happiness. People come here to re-energize, take this joy back home, and even improve their lives.
The structure is not designed to be used for religious services, but as described by its founder, to serve as a temple of culture and truth. Deborah Block, VOA News.
Technology is very quickly changing entertainment as we know it. While some worry that people are spending too much time on video games, not enough time with other people, there's a place in Los Angeles where visitors can interact with both. It's called the 2-Bit Circus, a funhouse that incorporates technology and games with group play for people of all ages. Details now from VOA's Elizabeth Lee.
Imagine traditional carnival games on steroids. That's pretty much the experience at 2-Bit Circus.
I think it takes the whole arcade game venue to the next level. And there's a couple of games I played tonight where I was out of breath and actually sweating.
Games infused with technology such as cameras and sensors aim to give visitors a new way to play.
Okay, they're all over!
In a twist to escape rooms, visitors can immerse themselves in group adventures, like when they ride a river raft while shooting aliens in virtual reality.
Press right white, it says press right white.
Or navigate a spaceship with friends. Even getting a drink is high-tech entertainment with this robot bartender.
I have not had a robot make my drink before, and that was actually pretty cool. He even managed to shake it.
The 2-Bit Circus is a platform that offers the latest innovative games, many of them created here.
We're standing here in the 2-Bit Circus shop, and the 2-Bit Circus shop shares a wall with the 2-Bit Circus park, and that means that we can build stuff here in the morning and test it out there in the evening.
Force field activated.
And we have a really incredible team of creative people who are always experimenting with new forms of entertainment. And we have the most important ingredient of all, people to test this stuff on.
Co-founder Eric Gradman used to build prototypes for the military, such as robots and self-driving cars. He also had a completely different career as a circus performer.
I was touring around the country, doing crazy stuff on stage in front of thousands of people. And this place is a great way to combine those two loves, making stuff and performing.
Co-founder Brent Bushnell is a trained clown with a background in engineering. He also happens to be the son of Nolan Bushnell, the founder of video game company Atari.
My dad wants to move in here. He freaking loves this place. And, you know, he comes back, he's always got ideas and you know, what things we should change, what we should do differently. But he really, you know, he's obsessed.
This Los Angeles-based micro-amusement park is about the size of a department store for a reason. As more stores close due to competition from online shopping, 2-Bit Circus hopes to open parks in some of those empty spaces.
We have built it to be able to just slot right in. And so for me, that brings real scale, right? That format exists in 100 cities across the country. So we can then iterate and test, optimize this version here, and then replicate it across the country.
And they say maybe one day in other countries around the world. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
This is Science in a Minute.
The chemical makeup of Earth's atmosphere is said to contain about 78% nitrogen and 21% oxygen, with argon, carbon dioxide, and other gases making up the remaining 1%. But in the atmosphere of what is considered to be the hottest, ultra-hot exoplanet found so far, scientists in Switzerland and Germany say they have found vapors of iron and titanium. The scientists say they were able to detect these heavy metals because of the incredibly hot surface temperature of the planet. Discovered last year, the exoplanet KELT-9b is said to have a day-side temperature of between 3800 and 4300 degrees Celsius. Scientists say the reason the exoplanet is so hot is because it orbits its host star, which is almost twice as hot as our sun, from a distance that's 30 times closer than the Earth's distance from the sun. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. Our thanks to you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Dan Crafton, our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team of Jim Stevenson, Skylar Ogden, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Enjoy your day.